Voices of the Temple, official podcast of the Temple of Witchcraft, exploring mystery and magic through love, will, and wisdom, hosted by Adam Sartwell. Hi, everybody, and welcome to Voices of the Temple. This is our Scorpio podcast. I got to talk with the current Scorpio minister, Chris, and our future Scorpio minister, Elsa. And before I get too far along, let me just bring us into a sacred space together by doing our invocation. I call to the Great Spirit. I call to the two who move as one. Through the three rays of love, will, and wisdom, I call upon the goddess, maiden, mother, crone, past, present, and future, creator, sustainer, and destroyer, weaver of the web. I call to the God, Lord of light and Lord of darkness, God of the green and the gold, God of the horn and the red, singer of the song. Be with us now and forever, so mote it be. Now, having that done, I did want to talk about a couple of things before I started, but this podcast is so long that I may have to shorten up what I can talk about. Elsa and Chris and I had a long conversation about sex, death, you know, all of the wonderful Scorpionic things in this podcast, and I don't want to take up any more time than it actually has to. But I did want to say that our lost ancestor was found. We had a picture left over from Samhain that finally made it back to its home. We had a very successful silent auction at Samhain, which our coordinator is going to set up for two more events this year. I'm not really sure. I think she said two more. We also, I have to say, at Yule, we are not doing the food drive. We are doing a drive for Toys for Tots. So bring an unwrapped toy to the circle so that we can donate them to Toys for Tots. Now, when they say unwrapped, it means, like, you know, not wrapped in, you know, paper or whatever. It doesn't mean, you know, you should take it out of the package. It should be in its original package, but not wrapped in paper or in a new package. So they can see it and know what it is so they can give it to the right kid. We just had our Witchcraft 2 initiations and Witchcraft 5, both of which I was in attendance at, and they were both amazing. So many cool and amazing things going on there that I can't talk about them because I have to get on with the interview. I also have to put out a call to all of my listeners. If you have Temple Fest pictures from last year, could you please send them to Gemini@templeofwitchcraft.org? We had some people who came from far away and didn't bring their camera and really would like to have some mementos and pictures of their time that they spent there. And yeah, so I really want to encourage everyone to, you know, share those. Our Gemini minister is going to be putting more and more pictures up. He needs more pictures of different events. So if you have some, please email them to him. Make sure, please, that they're okay to show to the public. If they're not, just tell him. There may be a way to get them to people who want them, even if, you know, they're not public. So, we'd like to solve that. But without further ado, I'm just going to put the podcast interview on, and you can listen to it. It was a amazing conversation, and I hope you enjoy it. Blessed be.
And we are with Chris, the
current
lead, and you know, soon to be leader, Elsa,
yes,
of the Scorpio Ministry.
Hello.
Yes, you can say hi to the listeners. So to let our listeners get to know both of you, let's talk a little bit about your spiritual trainings and your backgrounds. Chris, if you'd like to go first.
Sure. So what brought me to witchcraft, or paganism in general? I was born and raised Catholic, in a good Italian Catholic and Irish Catholic family. And when I was 14 years old, I always felt called to be a priest, and I always wanted, or a priestess, or, you know, I wanted to walk that yeah, journey.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was about 14 years old, I said, I went up to the priest and I said, I've got two quick questions for you. And if you can answer these two questions, then I think I have a calling to be a priest.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, okay, well, what are your two questions? I said, if God's all good, what created the bad option? And he looked at me and he thought, you know, that I was being insolent, and he mm-hmm. told me so.
Yes.
You know, it's all about free will. And I said, no, but God's all good and all powerful and all knowing. So what created the bad option? And he didn't quite get it. So I said, you know, if I'm a human and you're a human, we can make another human. We can't make a monkey, a goat, or a dog.
Mm-hmm.
If God is all good, where did the bad stuff come from? Like, you know, and he got very upset with me, and I said, okay, well, on to the next question. If God's a man, how do you create a woman? And he said, well, he's not a man. And I said, well, then why don't we use the pronoun it? Well, it would be disrespectful. And I said, well, then why don't we say she? And he said, well, that would be even more disrespectful. And I thought, yeah, well, I don't belong here.
Wow.
Because the reason I had been Catholic for so long and the reason I stayed Catholic was the Virgin Mary. I was, like, totally devoted to the, you know, the imagery of the goddess in the Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said, I got to find something else. And so I started studying religions. I looked at Judaism, and I looked at Hinduism and Buddhism, and each one was confusing and odd in its own way. And then one afternoon, I was in Wordsworth Bookstore in Harvard Square, where I would hang out on Saturday afternoons after buying our comic books. And behind the stairwell in Wordsworth Book, there was this tiny little section, it was about five books deep,
mm-hmm.
called The Occult. And I think it had, like, Starhawk Spiral Dance, Richard Cavendish's The Black Arts, Paul Huston's Mastering Witchcraft, mm-hmm. and I bought all four books.
Yeah.
And I just went home, and I just remember reading it, in particular Richard Cavendish's Black Arts, and the very first chapter was like, you know, God encompasses all of these polarities. It's not about God being all good and all, and therefore having this polarity of all bad, but that, you know, the divine spark of the universe creates everything. And I thought, wow, I was like, that's really brilliant. And then I started reading, then I read Starhawk, and I was like, goddess worship, yeah, that's it, you know, and I was mm-hmm. totally gung-ho about that. And so then, 14, 15, 16, you know, up into college, and then in college I started, in undergraduate, I got a bachelor's degree in philosophy with minors in women's studies and religious studies and a concentration in feminist liberation theology. And then I decided to go on to graduate school, what I was going to do with a master's in feminist liberation theology. I had no idea, but that's what I wanted to study.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in graduate school at Episcopal Divinity School, and I had this one professor, ancient Hebrew, and all I cared about was the goddess. Like, you know, I want to know about the Shekinah. And he got really angry that all I wanted to talk about was the Shekinah,
mm-hmm.
because, you know, as far as he was concerned, the Shekinah wasn't really that important, and I was like, are you out of crack? I'm like, you know what I mean? Have you read anything at all? And I had just had sort of a blowout with this professor, who will remain nameless, and I was sitting in the cafeteria, and this woman walked over to me, and she said, she was in the class, and she said, you know, if you really want to know about the goddess, you should travel to places where the goddess still exists. And I said, yeah, you know, I've read about Hinduism, and because that's the only place that I had read that the goddess still existed was in sort of like, you know, Hinduism and some Tibetan Buddhist stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, I'm not talking about Hinduism, I'm talking about Africa. And I was like, Africa? What are you talking about? And so it turns out that she was a priestess of the Orisha Yamaya, Mm-hmm. And she had been initiated in a village in South Carolina, which is a traditional Yoruba village.
Yeah.
And she said, you know, I'm going to Africa. Do you want to come? You know, and I'll hook you up with the right people and we'll go over and, you know, I'll introduce you around and you can have the full experience. And I was like, yeah. So dropped out of graduate school and took the money I would have spent on a semester of graduate school. And I traveled to Nigeria. I spent 6 weeks in Nigeria. I traveled to Brazil. I spent a couple of weeks in Brazil. I traveled to Cuba. I spent a couple of weeks in Cuba. I went to, and then I was going to go to Haiti because I was trying to understand the concept of the African gods in diaspora. How did these divinities stay alive in these various cultures? Mm-hmm. Like, you know what I mean? And for me, a living religion is a religion that changes to meet the needs of the people. Mm-hmm. You know, it has to metamorph. It has to change. It has to be constantly moving because if it stagnates, it dies. And so I went to these places where, in diaspora, the religion had stayed alive. Yeah. Either under the, you know, in Brazil it stayed alive as Candomblé, in Cuba it stayed alive as Lucumi and Santeria. I wanted to go to Haiti, but at the time Haiti had just erupted with a big coup, and I wasn't going to get to Haiti. And so I went to Guatemala instead. And that blew my mind as well. I mean, at dawn, I was staying in this tiny little village in the mountains, living in like a flea-infested, sleeping on a flea-infested cot. It was great. Eating guinea pig and, you know, all these... Mm. Yeah, exactly. Mm. But every morning, all of the women in the village would put on these really beautiful, vibrant shawls, and they would go out to the cornfield, and they would sing these songs to the sun, that the sun would rain his seed down on Pachamama, the earth, so that the corn would grow. And then they would, I mean, at dawn, you know, they're up at dawn, and then they would all, like, you know, teeter back to their huts. They would put on these little black veils, and they'd all go to church. And I was like... the incongruity of this, like, you know, how do you maintain this? Like, how do you do it in your heads? Mm-hmm. And, you know, these women were like, well, you know, the Holy Father does this every morning. He sings a song to the sun that he will rain down his seed on Pachamama, that the corn. And I said, no, he doesn't. And they said, yes, he does. And then I decided not to argue because, you know, you weren't getting anywhere with the argument. And it was just, and I think that's when things like started to, you know, congeal for me. And I studied the tradition. I started studying Lucumi and Santeria here in the United States. It's a very different religion than the religion that you see in Africa. And then I went, you know, studied a little bit more from the African perspective, and was on my way to initiation within the tradition. And, you know, a gay white man in a traditionally machismo, you know, black and Latino religion ain't going to get too far. You have to go that extra mile to earn the respect of anybody. And I was like, you know, I don't need to bust my ass to get you guys respect. And if you don't see it, that's not my problem. And there were other little issues that kind of popped up. Like, my ancestors were like, no, you know, no, this is where he needs to be. And, you know, all of my readings pulled me away from the more Afrocentric stuff, although that's really the work, like, you know what I mean? When I do magic, I always come at it from that perspective. Mm-hmm. But my ancestors really kind of pulled me back and said, no, there's something within the European traditions that's just as vibrant, that's just as alive. Mm-hmm. It's just that you have to find it. And the great thing about the African traditions is that there's no break. You know what I mean? There's it goes boom, boom, boom. In the European traditions, there's a break because of, you know, the burning times and the Inquisition and the Crusades and, you know, name it. Mm-hmm. There's this definite break between our sort of pagan ancestors and who we are and what we're doing today. Mm-hmm. But the work that I learned in the African tradition with the ancestral stuff allowed me to tap into sort of ancestral memories and tap into ancestral stuff and draw that energy through. And sort of awoke a lot of things within me that allow me to do sort of this weird combination of, like, you know, African stuff. But, like, you know, okay, so the African tradition calls for a cassava melon. Well, I've got a turnip over here, you know what I mean? Or whatever the case may be. And you learn how to, you know, how to syncretize things and how to make do, which I think is really what magic is all about. It's like, you know, what's practical in the moment? What are we going to do right here, right now? What do we have at our disposal that's going to sort of awaken and cajole that stuff out of us? How, you know, because we're the magic, like, you know. I'm a Pratchett witch, like, you know what I mean? Your finger is a wand and a puddle is a, you know, scrying palm. And that's what it comes down to, you know?
You gotta just use what you got.
You gotta, exactly.
Quote, weather wax.
Exactly. You know, it's all etymology.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
So that sort of, you know, in a nutshell, that's, and, you know, who I am and what I do today is, you know, it's my own sort of combination, you know, mixed and matched, and, you know, I've worked Celtic, I've worked Teutonic, I've worked Germanic, I've worked African, I've worked, you know, my ancestry is, you name it, it's in there somewhere, you know, you go far enough back and, you know, we're all from the same place anyway,
Well, I think that's one of the best things about witchcraft, is that you can explore so many religions and take, I'm kind of, we're scavengers in a way, but we pick up things and take them with us,
right,
and make them a part of ourselves, and it's sort of that soul crafting of,
right,
this is my path.
Right. Yes. It's almost like witchcraft is the philosophy of it. Do you know what I mean? Like, I mean, witchcraft doesn't necessarily have to be spiritual, or, like, it doesn't have to have a spiritual or you know, traditionally religious aspect to it, like, you know what I mean? Because you can be a Christian witch, you know, Jesus and Mary acting as your goddess and your god. You can be a Jewish witch.
Yeah.
You can be, you know what I mean? You can come at it from any perspective. It's just, you know, educating people about the word witch and changing how people perceive and understand. Because in Africa, you don't call yourself a witch.
Yeah.
Like, you want to be burned at the stake, call yourself a witch. Like, you know what I mean? There's
they're still doing that.
And they still do. Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know what I mean? There are words, but it's because the history of what a witch is, you know what I mean? And there are words for people who practice the magic who are not witches, you know what I mean? So the witch itself, the in Nigeria there, the Ia, Awonjuaye, which means the mothers of the beautiful birds.
Hmm.
So, but in order to become a witch, you have to kill somebody you love. Like, you know, that's the mentality, that's the belief that, you know what I mean? In order for you to be, if your husband dies unexpectedly, you know, you must have killed him because you're trying to, you know, you're trying to gain access. And only women are witches.
Yeah.
You know, in Nigeria, the men work the ancestral stuff, the Egungun stuff, and the women work the witchcraft stuff. You know what I mean? And there's sort of this balance that exists, but you don't go around proudly, you know what I mean, wearing a, you know, 24 karat gold pentacle on your chest going, woohoo, witch! You know? It's, unless you like being charbroiled.
So, Elsa.
Yes.
Tell us about your background.
Well, my family was very interesting. My mother was an astrologer who was very interested in all the occult. And but she was, at the time of her life, was a time when it just wasn't, she didn't feel okay, I think, with it. So she was very Christian in her, you know, presentation.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm going through her books now. She's passed, and it's just incredible books. I'm like, oh, good, I've got this now, you know?
That's out of print.
Out of print. Civil League. Okay, good. So, but she was very open. She remembered her past lives and such, so I had a very fertile ground for exploring the occult and the hidden ways. And so I started, actually, with astrology and with tarot in my 20s. And and still sort of considering myself a Christian, because it was hard. That's the relationship with my mother, you know. It's just easier for me to be a Christian and still talk to her, you know, frankly. And then as I got closer into my 30s, I started doing more study in pagan and women's circle stuff, and, you know, Diane Stein and Starhawk and all that. And I was like, no, this is more who I am. You know, and everything's sacred. And I had an aunt who was a Baha'i. She said, I studied all religions, the Baha'i's the one that made sense. But she would say things to me like, that aunt over there is sacred. You know, everything has a soul or a spark. So that's another feeling that came from my childhood. So eventually I went into more formal study. I took some classes with Lori Cabot, and I started taking classes with R.J. Stewart and John Matthew. So I did the Celtic and some Egyptian and that kind of thing, and really found kind of a groove and an understanding of the inner spark of life being everywhere through the R.J. Stewart stuff. And and so that's how I went along, and I studied with all these people. I also studied Reiki and these kind of angelic readings, that kind of thing, the angelic oracle deck. So working with angels, working with, you know, that kind of thing. And then I had known Christopher, and then I found when I read his work and speaking with him, he pulled from all the kind of same places I did. And my whole time I was like, how do I plate all these things together into a cohesive braid? Yeah. You know, because I was like, well, I'm doing the angel stuff, or I'm, you know, I was very segmented and floodgates in my brain about them. Mm-hmm. And so I just completed Witchcraft 5. So I did 3, 4, and 5 with him, because I'd done 1 and 2 kind of already. So yeah, he felt I could move to that. And I was like, oh, there I am. That's who I am. It's kind of brought me all together in a sense. You know, yeah. I had a way of looking at it. Made you coherently.
Less, yeah, made you less segmented and more right. holistic.
And fragmented, so I became more holistic. And so that was very important. I also did a course of study at Lesley in holistic counseling and psychology, which also brings in another layer. So, and that was very holistic and bring all seven kind of layers of who we are together in your psychotherapy practice, my psychotherapy practice. So that's,
yeah,
it was just all kind of... It's like a capstone kind of year this year for me.
Cool. So, Elsa, you just finished Witchcraft 5.
Right.
Can you tell us what it's like to go through all of the trainings, and, you know, what does your initiation feel like?
Yeah. Well, I kind of addressed that, but it kind of brought all my trainings together.
Yeah.
You know, and it exposed me to something I hadn't been exposed to. Witchcraft 4 is the ceremonial magic, and I sort of was exposed to it, but not in a systematic manner.
Yeah.
And that was really incredible for me, to have kind of the... A lot of what my spiritual path had been before, doing the work with live the teachings of the temple, was very intuitive and feel, and not a lot of intellectual academic kind of study. So
yeah.
Bringing in that, and I'm very much an academic intellectual as well.
Mm-hmm.
So bringing that part in really was powerful for me, in that something the teachings of the temple brought to me,
mm-hmm.
as well as a very nice systematic way of dealing with your shadow and the work in Witchcraft 3.
Yeah.
Which was parallel to my work in my counseling studies, because we do a lot of work there that integrates your shadow as well. They don't use that language, but...
Yeah, they use different languages.
Yeah, but... close to it. Jung sometimes brings that language in. But my initiation, which was just Saturday...
mm-hmm. Yeah.
it was quite... an intense time, because it just, there's just so many images and things I'd forgotten that were now able to come in, like,
mm-hmm.
you know, fragmented parts were able to come back in. You know, you did some of that in 3, bringing in the mm-hmm. parts, but in the shamanic work. But I think just about everyone got home, you know, to put it that way. So I just felt more coherent, and like I kept saying, I've come home to me, I guess, is the... There's a terrible song, that name from the 60s that we won't, or no, the 70s that we won't think about. It's a terrible song. But,
Never Been to Me.
Never Been to Me, that's it. It's a terrible song. But
it's not terrible.
Well, it's giving all the power to the man.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. As opposed to having the power in yourself, which the initiation gave it.
So, to ask both of you, do you define yourself as a witch, or do you use another label? Or do you use multiple labels?
It took me, actually, when Christopher and I first met, like 15 years ago, I think he had actually had a conversation with a friend of mine who said to him, I was managing Unicorn Bookstore at the time, and he said to a friend of mine, the guy who works downstairs, is he a witch? And she said to him, well, yes, he is, but you don't want to say that to him. You know?
Yeah.
It was Catherine. you don't want to say that to him. It wasn't that I didn't have a negative connotation or feeling about the word. I just felt that the word itself, it required a certain level of maturity and integrity. Mm-hmm. And it's not that I question that I had the maturity and integrity, but I don't think that, I don't feel that you can go, I'm a witch, and all of a sudden you're a witch. You know what I mean? I think, I say this over and over again to a lot of people, but like, to be a witch means that, you know, you're taking responsibility for your participation in the universe. Mm-hmm. You know, you take responsibility for you take risks at you know, integrating your shadow. You take emotional risks at vulnerability so that you can become available to affect change. Mm-hmm. You know, you take risks at challenging your belief systems in order to break down old dogmatic crystallized thought patterns in order to make way for new ideas that are going to grow and feed you as an individual. And you take risks at creating environments that are designed to nurture, sustain, and support you so that you can in turn nurture, sustain, and support other people. And I think that, you know, for a 22-year-old or a 23-year-old, and, you know, it's not chronological necessarily, but...
Yeah.
There is a certain level of maturity that I think you have to kind of get to with yourself mm-hmm. in order to really claim that word. And so it was I didn't really take the word until I was probably in my late 30s. And that's when I started referring to myself. Like, you know, I mean, in my heart and in my head, I always thought of myself as a witch. I mean, I've thought of myself as a witch since, you know, it was in Dora in the corner. You know what I mean? Yeah. No, I didn't want to be Samantha. I wanted to be in Dora. You know, I love the, you know, the green and pink chiffon. You're going to get that.
Yeah.
Woo! You know?
Yeah.
The big, great orange wig. Thank God for Agnes. But, yeah, I mean, so the whole, you know, that was always in me. Like, you know what I mean? I always looked at the world differently. I always thought about the world differently. I always, you know, I always felt like, you know what I mean? If I'm going to affect change, I'm going to have to participate here. Or I'm going to have to do something, you know?
Yeah.
And which means sometimes it just means speaking up. And sometimes it means not speaking up and, you know, mm-hmm. and learning those places. So in my 30s, I started really saying, you know, I'm a witch.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And saying, you know, and I'm so out of the broom closet, you know what I mean? Like, if you don't know that I'm a witch, you're either deaf, dumb, and blind, or all of the above, and you're not paying attention, you know?
Yeah.
You know, I'm like 6'7", you know, 260-pound gay white man walking at you, so, you know, I don't hide well, you know? I don't hide well, so.
He's not a shy retiring.
Yeah, I'm not the shy, retiring flower. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I'm kind of, you know, a little out there. And I can be very in your face if that's what it takes. But, you know, that's not where I'm going to go with it. But I mean, I've identified, you know, I identify as a witch. You know what I mean? As pagan, as a witch, as, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So how about you, Elsa?
Well, I've had to warm up to the word as well. Part of it is my kind of inherent desire to build bridges. I find that if if I say I'm a witch right up front, there's a wall that may erect and I'll never get through.
Mm-hmm.
An example is I had a housemate who had a very clear psychic bond with, and he was very Christian, and at one point he just said, you know, what I feel and understand about you is not what I associate with that word. So it's really been a big opening, because, you know, you're housemates, so you don't hide that much.
Yeah.
And in other cases, it's like, one way I put it is I'm a you witch, in a sense, because it's like I want to build the bridges and help you. I really understand that, you know, it's all the same.
Yeah.
It's all the same path. The best example, I guess, is when one day I went back into work and I said to my coworker, I told my mother I was a witch last night. And she said, what happened? And I said, well, I didn't say witch. And I described how to cast a circle and the qualities I invoke at each area and the going into the trance and all that. And she was just so impressed because she was very much... psychic and into the occult. She was like, wow, that sounds wonderful. Your practice sounds incredible. And I never once told her it was witchcraft. I never once said it was paganism, you know, but that got her, that was the most important one to cross the bridge yeah. with. And, you know, maybe someday I could have told her, but I didn't get a chance to use yeah. those words. So my answer is yes, I do, but I also try to build the bridges.
Yeah.
Because I feel that's important.
I found in my own practices that my ancestors have become more forgiving once they've passed the veil. Mm. Like,
oh, yes.
Yeah. Very and then they're like,
oh, mom's totally down with it now.
Oh, okay. That's what was going on. Okay. You know, and they seem to accept it a little bit more. Right.
Well, my mom came through in a reading.
True for everyone.
My mom came through at a reading with a medium I know. She was like, she really liked Christopher. She said, "That good, follow that one, follow that." You know, and I was like, "Oh, good, you're cool with this now." You know, she was very happy. So it was a big healing moment.
Yeah.
For that relationship.
Yeah, I do think that the word witchcraft can shut down people if they have preconceptions
exactly.
about what it is. In my own stuff, like at work and, you know, like I let them get to know me.
Right. Exactly.
Then I say, oh yeah, I'm
exactly.
a witch.
Exactly.
And like, it's funny because I had to come out because, there's a certain festival I go to every year that I'm actually, you know, ministering and doing the work. And I had to say, well, this is my calling and detail what my calling was to my job, and then, you know, make sure that they understood that this time of year I will be gone. Whether or not, you know, I have this job after, I don't care. That's my calling, not
right.
this.
Right.
And after saying that, it was like, oh, okay. And they, like, a light had gone on in their
right.
minds. It was kind of cool.
But I think also sometimes just saying the word, just putting it out there.
Mm-hmm.
Opens up a conversation that under normal circumstances never would have happened. And
mm-hmm.
so,
yeah.
you know what I mean?
True.
You kind of, like, I just expect, well, which often I'm disappointed, but I kind of have this expectation that everybody's just, you know, I am who I am. Like, if you don't
yeah.
like it, you don't have to look at it. But, like, you know what I mean? If we're going to have to work together, this is, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I've got,
mm-hmm.
I mean, my office is, you know, my office
yes.
looks like,
I know.
You know.
It's a big shrine.
It's a big shrine to the great mother, you know what I mean? You know, and what's hysterical is, I mean, I deal with a lot of low-income, disenfranchised people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they come into my office and they see, you know, I've got my little shrine to Guadalupe up there, and I've got, like, you know, the Black Madonna Chechishova up there, and you know what I mean? And so my clients are like, oh, I know her. Like, you know what I mean? And immediately
mm-hmm.
everything is fine. You
yeah.
know what I mean? Because, you know, I'm like, well, you know, you call her Mary, and I call her Mary, and,
yeah.
you know, it's all the same goddess, you know
mm-hmm.
what I mean? It's all the same concept of divine. And they're, oh, like, you know what I mean? Oh, that's, so I think a lot
mm-hmm.
of times it's a learning experience.
Yeah.
It has that, you know what I mean? If you're open about it. And I think also if you approach it with a certain level of confidence and satisfaction in who you are, and you're not trying to hide it, like, you know what I mean? You're just like, this is just who I am. It's kind of like being gay, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, think about how difficult it is coming out. You know, I mean, when I told my mother I was gay, she was just like, well, you know,
mm-hmm.
where do you put
stunned.
That? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They're stunned. And it's like, because I know who you, I thought I knew who you were, and now you're telling me this
right.
about you.
Right.
And it's like, but I'm still that same person.
Mm-hmm.
So at this point in my life, I'm like, this is who I am. Like, you know what I mean? I know you see this big sitfuk, you know, gay white guy, but I'm really a little black lesbian working it all out through a big white box. And you know what I mean?
yeah.
You know, and that kind of breaks the ice. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It gives people an opportunity.
Yeah.
It opens up a conversation. I mean, I work with a lot of very Christian, you know what I mean, born again
mm-hmm.
Christian people, and they're just like, oh, like, and they just don't seem to, it just doesn't matter, you know
yeah.
what I mean? And a lot of people are like, you know, oh, it would definitely matter at my work. And I'm like, do you know that? Like, do you
yeah.
know that, or have you spun a scenario where you can't be, oh, you can't be
yeah.
yourself?
Because yeah.
if you can't be yourself, how are you being authentic with people? And how can you
mm-hmm.
invite them to be authentic with you?
Yeah.
You know, now, I mean, obviously everybody's situation is different. We're living in the Northeast.
Yeah.
And we have a certain level of, you know, academia
mm-hmm. yeah.
and, you know,
intelligence.
And we're
mm-hmm.
not living in the Bible Belt or,
mm-hmm.
you know, where they burn crosses on your lawn.
Yeah.
But not that that only happens in the Bible Belt, but.
Mm. Yeah. yeah, I feel like
we are lucky here, and I do think that out there, people could come out more, and the courage and the daring to come out there gives us a teaching moment for people who may need a little more education about it. Like, I don't know. I came out both as a witch and as a gay man at the same time because I wanted to get it all done. Okay, here you go. I'm done. You know, so...
See, I was pagan forever and then, like, you know, told my mother I was gay and she's like, oh, great, just one more freaking thing.
Yeah. I believe there was well, now you have two strikes against you. Like, you know, going out there in the world. And I found that people pretty much accept me for who I am. Mm-hmm.
I think if you yourself feel confident in what it is that you're presenting, who's going to question you? Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? And if they have questions about it, then that's great. Ask them the questions.
Right.
But don't go about assuming things about me, because that's not going to get us anywhere, you know?
And I find, to the people that I work with, they're like, you know, you really do have it together. You know, like, wow, you know, how did you do this? And I'm like, well, I have spirituality, I have witchcraft, you know, I use my intuition, I use my power to change things all the time. And they're like, it's like you have a magic touch. And I'm like, well, I do. You know, that's what the whole witch thing's about. Okay. So,
cross-referenced witch.
Cross-referenced
witch, yes. So... as, you know, the current leader and the leader hereafter, what does the Scorpio Ministry do? And what have you done, like, in the past year? And what are your plans for the future? It's a lot of questions.
Yeah. No, it's okay. Well, I mean, the Scorpio Ministry itself, initially, when Christopher started talking about establishing the temple, Christopher and I have been friends for years, because I'm Chris, I'm the other white meat. And there's Christopher, and that's how we distinguish each other when we're in a crowded room. But when he first started talking about it, I mean, I was kind of intrigued by the whole idea of it, and, you know, then he said, I'm having a really hard time finding somebody to do Scorpio because it, you know, requires a lot of, you know, there's a lot of sensitivity and a lot of weird feelings around death and dying, and, you know, Scorpio really is a lot of the shadow work. And, you know, me and the Dark Goddess were like this.
Yeah.
We've been in bed together forever now, you know.
For those of you who couldn't see, he's got his fingers really close together.
So I said to Christopher, well, I'll tell you what, I'll give you a year, and, you know, and we'll see, and I'll see where things are going, and I'll see who's, like, who else is in the group. And really the focus for this past year, which is really the first year that we've been getting together and working, has really been focusing on talking about how we as a group can sort of educate and change people's perceptions about death. You know, death is a natural part of the process. You know what I mean? It's where the, you know, the little I, the little me sort of gives it all up. And, you know, it's that ultimate last sacrifice. And traditional civilized cultures have worked really hard to avoid having to talk about death and dying. Have, you know, we live in a culture where we put our elderly, disabled, we lock them away. It's not something we want to see. We don't want to look at old age. Don't want to look at the sickness. We don't want to look at death.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we've alienated ourselves from it. And I think I was raised like that. You know, I was raised with this. My grandfather was in a nursing home for the last 15 years of his life.
Yeah, we medicalized it.
Yeah, exactly.
It used to be you died at home.
Right. And this whole thing about death and dying, and, you know, when I was in Africa, and, you know, what chicken do you want for dinner? And you have to go out and wring the chicken's neck, and there's this reverence for life, you know, when you, I mean, even in Cuba and Brazil, like, you know what I mean, there's this genuine reverence for life, but there's this understanding that this animal is giving up its life so that you yourself can continue. And you're deluding yourself by thinking that this isn't ultimately going to happen to you. You know, you're going to feed the birds and the worms eventually yourself. So, you know, how do we as a tradition, how do we change sort of that perception about death, and how do we change our feelings about dying and so forth? And so I think the first, you know, Elsa and We've had three other women who have been regulars at the meetings, at the Scorpio meeting. We've been meeting every other month all year, just kind of getting together and talking about, you know, how do you go into that environment? Because when you're dealing with a person who's dying, 9 times out of 10, the biggest amount of work is dealing with the people who are left behind. Because the person who's dying has in some way, shape, or form, generally speaking, come to terms with it. Mm-hmm. And they're kind of just waiting for the last release. They're waiting to kind of give up the ghost, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And how do we make that process sacred? How do we, you know, how do we talk to that person? Christopher and I have been working on kind of creating some kind of vision work that you can do with a person who is passing over in a similar way to like the Tibetan Book of the Dead, where you read to the person, you know, about the vision, about, you know, where are you going and what are you seeing, and and sort of walking a person through that death vision, you know, and making it sacred, making, you know, bringing back that understanding of the sacredness of it, of the power of that moment for that individual, you know, and, so that's really been our focus, you know, trying to, and then also making a distinction between, you know, one of the big things when we first started was people kept saying, oh, well, we're going to do hospice. And I had to make that real distinction because I've done hospice. Like, you know, in the late 80s and early 90s, I had a lot of friends dying of AIDS. And I quote unquote did hospice, and doing hospice is, you know, getting in there and, you know, wiping asses and, you know, changing feeding tubes and, you know, that's doing hospice. And that's not what we do. You know, we had to make that distinction between, we're not there to be necessarily caregivers in that way, but that we're there to sort of do this spiritual work and not necessarily counseling, because counseling, you have to be, you know,
certified
and exactly. But, you know, just offering support, you know, just being present. Because I think bearing witness to something as powerful as that is really, is huge. It's huge for the person who's passing. It's huge for the people who are left behind, so to speak. And then just being with, you know, just bearing witness and being with the people and working with them during that process. And just letting them know, you know, if you need something, I'm here. You know what I mean? If you need me to cook a meal, or you need me to just... if you just need somebody to talk to. And people have approached me and said, you know, I'd really love to work in the Scorpio of ministry. And I've thought to myself, you know, when you're in that moment, it's not about you. It's not about you at all. And so if you're going to start telling them about you and your experience, that's not where we're... that's not what we need. What we need is listeners. We need people to, like I say, bear witness and listen and sort of participate in that way. And so that was really our focus, and trying, you know, eventually, Christopher's, the whole idea behind the Scorpio ministry is that once we've got our crap together, we then start to offer education to the rest of the temple. And I think, you know, Christopher's kind of talked about this in his, in when he does Witchcraft 5, doing it with the, when the people are going through the Scorpio aspect, and when you're talking about the Scorpio aspect and dealing with death and dying, because it is, it's a shadow aspect of our culture, you know, and it's not, you know, we don't want to shine a big bright light on it necessarily, but we at least want people to be less, you know, afraid of that aspect of it. And embrace it and sort of integrate it in such a way so that when you face it, because ultimately we all face it, there, you know that there's, you can do it. You know what I mean? I mean, ultimately you don't have any control over it because it happens when it happens. But so that was really our focus over this past year. And then we talked a lot about, sort of ancestral work, because that was sort of my focus. When I did a lot of the African traditional stuff, my primary focus, and I've worked in Native American cultures, I've worked in African cultures, I've worked in Celtic, I've worked in Norse, and no matter what group I wind up, you know what I mean? Immediately, like, you know, the ancestral people rock over and they're like, oh, you're with us. You know what I mean? Yeah. I'm like, I just got here. How do you know this? You know what I mean?
You're dead,
you know.
That's what you do.
That's what you do. Not in a spiritualist sort of way, but like, right. You know what I mean? Just that, you know, just that honoring and you know, sort of acknowledgement and you know, encouraging their interaction and their feedback with the living.
Yeah.
You know? Mm-hmm. And that's always been really powerful for me. And sometimes I'm just like, oh, you know, I'm a Leo. I want to bask in the sun and, you know, have a grand time, you know? Mm-hmm. And, you know, you're constantly dragging me into this shadow and I don't want to be in the shadow. I need a tan, you know, yeah. People understand. But that's just, you know, you get called to do the work you get called to do, you know, and you either do it or you get, you know, the back of your hand slapped repeatedly until they start moving on to other parts of your body.
Yeah.
So the work of the Scorpio ministry thus far this year has been, as a group, we've talked a lot about what kind of environment, like how would we deal with if we went into a particular environment?
Yeah.
How do we deal with it? Luckily, in an odd way, we haven't lost any members of the temple in the course of this year, knock on wood.
Yeah.
But there have been a couple of people who've lost parents and loved ones, and they're like, you know, how do I approach this from a pagan perspective? Where, yeah. You know what I mean? How do we as pagans, or how do we as witches approach this?
Mm-hmm.
And it's always interesting to me that, you know, that it, for me, it's just so intuitive. Like, you know what I mean? You light a candle, glass of water and a, you know, a lit candle and mm-hmm. a, you know, a picture of the person. It's just, that's, you know, for me, it's just so, that's just what I would do. But I notice that a lot of people, when they find themselves in that situation, all logic and intuition just completely goes mm-hmm. out the door. Mm-hmm. And they're just looking for somebody to kind of point them in the direction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so it's been a very simple, you know, this is how you set up like a simple ancestral sort of shrine or ancestral yeah. altar. And this eventually moves into a much larger altar if you have sort of an ancestral altar in your home. And, you know, trying to get people to understand, you know, people are like, well, I don't want to work with that ancestor because that ancestor, blah, blah, blah. And
yeah.
I don't want to do that because that ancestor was a bastard to me. And I'm like, I said this when I taught the ancestral workshop. I said, you know, we get the parents we need, not necessarily the parents we want. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And
regardless of how horrible our experience with these people were, you know, it made us who we are today.
Yeah.
And so, you know, how can we use this? How can we use it to our benefit? That's what we are. We're witches. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? We're about grabbing the opportunities and changing things. So if this is something that happened to me, whether it was good or bad, how do I use that? How do I tap into that? Where's that ancestor? And also understanding that this ancestor did it because it happened to them. And yeah. and probably it happened to that, you know what I mean? And it's yeah. a pattern. It's the Hindu word samskara mm-hmm. is a pattern of behavior that carries through many lifetimes.
Yeah.
And the samskara feeds the karma, and then the karma feeds the samskara. So you mm-hmm. just wind up in these... You know, you're in this vicious circle. So how yeah. do I break this pattern? Well, you break the pattern by identifying it and working up the courage to forgive it.
Yeah.
You know, and in the process of forgiving it, you become the stronger person, but the weaker link in that yeah. chain of karma.
Mm-hmm.
And it breaks. And it's not, you know, it's not pity. It's genuine compassion that allows you to break that chain of karma. It's that yeah. genuine compassion that you develop for that ancestor or that person that allows you to sort of create that place of forgiveness. Mm-hmm. And when you forgive it, you know, you step out of it. You know, that's, you know, not to get Christian, but like when Jesus mm-hmm. talked about, you know, if you look at the Bible, Jesus is like, you want to know what eternal life is. Eternal life is forgiveness. You know, you have to forgive the past.
Mm-hmm.
The past is dead.
Yeah.
That, you know, past means death. It's dead. It's done. It's over with. What you have to do is you have to constantly be stepping into the present moment.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't step into the present moment if you're carrying all of that hatred and sickness and death and that comes from the past with you. So how do you step into that present moment? How do you step into the future? Mm-hmm. Not even step into the future. How do you step into the present moment? And you can only step into the present moment by really letting go of everything that's happened before.
Yeah.
Which is really hard.
Yeah.
I mean, but once again, we're witches. We're here to do the work, you know?
Yeah.
That's, I say to people at work all the time, oh, you're a witch, you just don't know it. Because if you're doing the work, you know what I mean? You know, then you're a witch. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? As, regardless of what you call yourself, you know? I think that if you're really, if you're genuinely doing the work and you're participating, then, you know, that's what it's all about. That's what witchcraft is all about.
Yeah.
But I'm sorry, back to Scorpio.
Well, it's about ancestor work.
It's about, exactly. Yeah. Well, and it's what people don't realize.
They don't realize ancestor
work is a huge part of that. Mm-hmm. You know,
it's part of healing your family patterns, and,
which is like a sex scar. Yeah.
From what I've done with my own ancestors, there are some family patterns that I don't want to repeat, and I've forgiven the people who did it because they were just repeating the pattern and didn't realize that it was happening.
Right.
You know? And
my godmother would say to me, you know, in every family, the ancestors get behind one particular person and say, this is the person who's going to change it.
Yeah.
You know, and a lot of times that person is a person who suffers very much in that family because that, you know what I mean, the ancestors are really dogging you to change it. Like, you know what I mean? Get in there, do the work, and, you know, and luckily, you know what I mean, I just had the good sense to wake up. You know, and I think that a lot of people just need to kind of wake up and say, you know, the ancestors are getting behind me. You know, they're there to assist you in this process. So, you know, so if they're there to assist you, why not take them up on the offer? Like, you know what I mean? I don't look a gift horse in the mouth most of the times because I'm looking at the other end of the horse. But, you know, you gotta kind of get in there and get your hands dirty and do the work, you know? And that's, to me, that's just what being a witch is all about. It's about, you know, getting your hands dirty and doing the work.
So, to paraphrase what you said about what you've done in the past year is to basically flush out what's going to happen when you actually talk to someone who is dying or the bereaved, and clarify how do we make this sacred?
Right.
How do we shine a light onto that shadow and say, oh, that's what's there. That's death. And this is a learning experience. And sort of bringing it into that scorpionic, because Scorpio rules sex and death, which are both powerful experiences, but they can be good and they can be bad.
Right, yeah.
Right.
Both of them can shoot you into enlightenment or it can damn you.
Right.
Either way.
Scar you.
And scar you.
Yeah.
Either one of those. Because they're both so initiatory. So, I think that sort of sums up what you're saying, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So, Elsa, where are we going with the future?
Where are we going? Well, we're going to, of course, continue with work, helping people understand the ancestral shrines and the work with the ancestors being part of this process. And approaching various hospitals and places and letting them know we're there if they have a pagan client who needs a patient that needs services, you know, needs a minister. I'm not sure what else we're going to do. We're still formulating what we're going to be doing next. I would think we'd be doing also some more just outreach and to the community to understand about what our services are, basically.
Yeah. Sort of talking with Christopher in the Sagittarius ministry and where are the teaching opportunities?
Right.
Where do you want us to step in and do, you know what I mean? I did the workshop on Samhain, but, you know, is there something more, like, you know what I mean? Is there something more in depth? Like, you know, how are, you know, Christopher and I are still working on sort of this bardo concept of, like, you know, death and dying and working with the person who's going through death and dying. And maybe, you know, just doing, I mean, I've done sort of death vision work alive. Like, you know what I mean? And walking through it and having this really profound and remarkable experiences. And I don't think it's for everybody.
Right.
You know, I don't think that, I don't think shadow work is for everybody. Yeah. Like, you know what I mean? I'm big on shadow work. I love shadow work. Like, you know what I mean? And I jump in and, you know, woohoo.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Jump into the darkness.
You know, I am the darkness.
Surprise!
You know?
Yeah.
I've been called that a couple of times, actually, now that I think of it. But, you know, just the, you know, there's so much, you know, I talk about, like, you know, the shadow work and the dark goddess, and I talk about it as like a compost heap in your unconscious mind. Like, I had my great-great-grandfather, I was lucky enough to know my great-great-grandfather, and he had this compost heap in his backyard that he would, like, you know, and in the wintertime we would go out and you could see, like, you know, the heat rising off of it, and he would throw a match at it and it would, like, burst into blue flame because it was giving off this great methane gas.
Yeah.
And then he would put it out and he would stick a pitchfork on it and turn it over.
Yeah.
And then he would throw a match at it and the flames wouldn't ignite because he turned it over, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, the shadow is sort of that part of our unconscious mind where we put everything we think we don't want, or things we think we've dealt with, or things that are too painful to deal with today, but, you know, and we kind of stuff it all in there.
Mm-hmm.
And if we don't go there and we don't work with it, you throw a match at it, it's going to burst into blue flame. You know what I mean? And people have, you know, breakdowns, psychological, emotional, and spiritual breakdowns, and they lose it and they don't know why they lost it or what was the trigger, you know. And the whole point in doing the shadow work is you go into that place, that, you know, that scary place, and you turn over, because at the bottom of that compost heap is the most fertile soil, you know what I mean? And then you spread that soil out over your garden and you plant something in it, you know, and you just got to know what you want to plant, and you got to be willing to, you know, to take a risk at planting it and, you know, and enjoying it when it comes up. So I think that there's, and in our culture, I think that death and dying and old age and sickness and all of that, that is such a huge part of our shadow. Like, you know, I mean, look at our advertising and, you know, I mean, everything about our world is about being young and beautiful and thin and, you know, and that doesn't even sum up the majority of the people who are living in the world, you know. So what are we saying about all of those things that are, quote unquote, terrifying to us? What about, you know,
and that we try to hide?
And that we try to hide.
We
you
try
know,
to shove
I mean,
in
I
the
just,
corner.
I just, it's just amazing to me how many people are, you know, they just, you know, I was with my grandmother when she died. Like, you know, and everybody's like, we're in a hospital room, and there's a hospital bed in the middle of this huge room, and everybody's standing at the outside of the, you know, they're standing up against the walls, and I'm like, what the hell is wrong with you people? You know, I'm taking down the bars of the bed and crawling into bed with my grandmother. And everybody's like, what the hell's wrong with you? You know? I'm like, you know what I mean? You people.
You want to say goodbye to your
You can't say goodbye to her from the door. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You gotta get
She's
over here.
Barely here.
You know?
She can't hear you.
exactly. You know, and then just, and I mean, you know, in the moment I was giving her Reiki because, you know, death is, it takes a lot of energy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It does.
You know what I mean? It takes a lot of energy. And here's this, you know, elderly, very sick woman lying in bed. You know, she's pulled out all her own tubes because she doesn't want to be here anymore. It's so obvious that she doesn't want to be here anymore. And everybody's trying to stick a tube back in her. And I'm like, get the damn tube away from her. She doesn't, she's done.
Yeah.
You know, and there's this weird thing in our culture where, oh, we have to keep the person alive. We have to keep, you know, and I'm all about quality of life. You know, quantity, you know, doesn't really, quantity isn't anything if you haven't lived, you know what I mean? What's the point in living to be 98 years old if you've never had any fun?
Yeah.
If you're a grumpy old man, unless you enjoy being a grumpy old man, which is entirely possible. But,
yeah. There are some people who do enjoy it.
Yeah, you know, I have a funny feeling I'll enjoy being a grumpy old man. Because, you know, I've been a grumpy old woman for quite some time now, you know, maybe I'll make that transition.
I can empathize with that feeling of, because having experienced that just last year with my dad, my mom and I were the ones who were in the room when he passed. And it was strange because my brothers had just left. And it seemed really odd that I would be the one that was there when he passed. And I thought, you know, well, the witch is the magic is change. So, you know, here I am. And I feel like my brothers had the stoic, oh man, I gotta stand back, I gotta be strong. And I was the one crying with my dad and talking with my dad and holding his hand and, you know, and it seemed like I had more of a connection and a healthier process through it because I was ready to accept that he was gonna go.
Right.
And
you accepted the change, you know what I mean? And that's really what death is. It's just, it's a process of change. It's just a change that we're not accustomed to, you know, because we're no longer sort of identifying with that limited eye. We're no longer dealing with that physical body. Mm-hmm. And so we think, you know, our relationship is over, it's done. But you can continue to have that relationship with that person. You know what I mean? And it can be even more rewarding and more powerful, you know, because when you open yourself up and allow yourself to have it from that ancestral space, you know? And it's just so uniquely, it's life altering. It changes who you are as an individual. It changes the core and sort of the, you know, I think it just changes your, you know, I don't want to say DNA, but it makes you as an individual a different kind of person.
Yeah.
When you look at it and you acknowledge sort of the sacredness of it and the power of it. I think it also sort of changes the I of who I am as an individual, because I start to understand, you know, something bigger than myself. I start to grasp something sort of, you know, that's traditionally ungraspable. And you only get that by bearing witness to that process, by, you know, participating in it and bearing witness to that process, you know?
And I just want to add to that, that we're not saying that it's not going to hurt.
No.
It hurts.
No. Yeah.
But it's
very,
definitely
very painful.
Open to it and to feel it and let it flow through you is such an amazing initiatory process to, you know, to a higher level of who you could actually be.
And the key word there is to flow through you.
Yeah.
Right.
Don't hold on to
it.
No.
Because then you end up with...
Then it really hurts.
Well,
really
then it becomes... Then it starts to feed the shadow again.
Right.
You know
and
I mean?
The samskara
you know
gets
I mean?
Very strong.
Yeah.
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 And the thing that I've seen recently in the medical system is a more of an acceptance. There's the development of palliative care and the development of hospice, where you deal with the pain, and more people saying, okay, I accept this diagnosis, if they've ended up with a terminal diagnosis, and saying, well, we could throw all this money at it, or I could, you know. So there's been more choosing.
There's more.
To have the dignity and to use the medical system to deal with the pain.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, to ease that more than, and to really more consciously approach. I mean, the hospice movement is amazing. I watched it with my mother, and with my uncle. Watching that process and watching it more.
20 years ago, everybody was like, oh, the hospice, that means that you're just taking them out and you're going to inject them and let them, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That you're the person who's going to have to kill them. Do you know what I mean? That you're going to give them that lethal injection.
No, there's
it's
no lethal
more
injection.
It's as they process exactly.
It's supposed
like,
to be lethal
you know,
injection if you don't have hospice. But.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you know, and so there's this, it's changing that whole misconception of what hospice is and what, and just like, you know what I mean, the whole concept of like, you know, dying at home. And,
yes.
And
yeah.
Just,
people
you know
are
I mean?
Getting
being,
to die at home again, which is
being
huge.
Being allowed to do that. I mean, my cat, you know, died a couple of years ago and the doctor was like, wow, that's amazing that your cat died at home, because most people don't even allow their cats to die at home. They take, you know, the cat gets to the point where they think, well, I'm not going to be able to take my care of my cat anymore, so I'm going to take it in to have it.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that that's not okay.
Yeah.
Right.
You know what
I
mean? But like, you know what I mean? The doctor was like, wow, you let your cat die at home. And I was just like, you know, what was the point? Like, you know what I mean? You know, he knew when he was going to go. What's the point of me bringing him in here so we can have, you know, heart attacks in your office? Because he hated the veterinarian. Why would I put the cat through that in his last couple of minutes?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Let him die at home. You know what I mean? And he did, you know. Of course, Corey had to deal with it because I was at work.
Oh, yes, sir.
So, I just wanted to talk, you guys taught, well, you taught a Samhain class on how to make an ancestor altar. So tell us a little bit about that, so maybe our listeners could, if they need to, make one and relate.
An ancestor altar. Yeah. Brief, like... Okay, so this is what goes on the ancestor altar. Traditionally on an ancestor altar, I mean, it can be as simple as a glass or a bowl of water, a light source, a constant light source. So, like, you know, some people don't like to have a candle lit in their house all the time. So you get one of those little, you know, electric lights that you put in your window at Christmas time. This is a great time to run out and buy a bunch.
Yeah.
And the electric one, though, not the
little,
battery one.
Yeah, no, the little electric one. You plug it in, you've got your light source, you know, you've got a bowl of water, and traditionally a picture of the loved one.
Mm-hmm.
It, you know, and so it can be as simple as that.
Yeah.
And to the altar, you know, if you're working with a particular ancestor, an ancestral altar is a working altar. It's not a devotional altar. And this is one of those places where, like, you know what I mean, the more monotheistic religions are like, oh, well, you know, you're worshiping your dead. No, we're not worshiping our dead. You know, we have reverence for our dead, and we acknowledge their assistance in the living world that we're
mm-hmm.
dealing with.
Yeah.
But we're not, it's not a devotional altar. It's a working altar. It's a space where you go and, you know, for some people, this just sounds so crazy, but, you know, you kind of feed your ancestors. And traditionally, you know, you feed them energy. So what's energy? Sugar is energy. Caffeine is energy. Nicotine is energy. Liquor is energy. These mm-hmm. are things that are... So, you know, you make them a nice, strong cup of coffee, and you put a good mm-hmm. tablespoon of molasses in it, and you just set the coffee by the, you know, by the picture. Or, you know, you're cooking up some meal for yourself, and you take a little bit of the meal and you put it in a small plate and you set it by their altar.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole idea is that they're on the other side, but they still need energy. They still need assist, you know.
Yeah.
They need energy. It's why we feed, you know, deities. You know what I mean? Why we give offerings mm-hmm. to deities. Why do we give offerings to deities? Because we're offering them energy.
Yeah.
So why not, you know, it's the same sort of thinking with the ancestors. So traditionally, you know, make a cup of coffee, or if you have if you're working with a particular ancestor like Jack Daniels, go out and buy them a small, you know,
mm-hmm.
what do you call those things? The
shot.
Taster?
Yeah, that was a taster.
Is it a taster? I don't know.
I have
the
no
little
idea.
Bottles.
Those little tiny
the
bottles.
Little bottles.
Bottles. Yeah. You can take airplane bottles.
You can tell we don't know.
We're all a bunch of alcoholics at this table. We don't
uh-huh.
know what they're called.
Yeah.
You know, you get them a little bottle of Jack Daniels and you open it up and put it in a shot glass for
mm-hmm.
them. I mean, just so it can be as simple as that. It can also be as elaborate as, I mean, you know, I have a relatively elaborate altar where I have, where there's a small bowl and in that, or a vessel, and in the vessel are white stones, and traditionally you use white stones. And each white stone is to represent sort of an ancestor or a line of ancestry.
Yeah.
You have there's a constant light source. There's a central bowl, which we call a well.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason you use water is because the soul speaks through water. So if you want to connect with sort of that soul energy, you would have water available. So there's a central well, and around the well there are 9 smaller glasses that are also filled with water.
Yeah.
I have a and this is the other thing that's kind of, this is an American take on it, because in Africa you would just have, you know, your deceased loved ones on the altar.
Yeah.
And understand that, you know, your ancestors are not the same as your partner's ancestors. So if you and your partner are both pagan and you're working it, you would want to have your ancestral altar and they would want to have their ancestral altar.
Oh.
So, and I mean, you can bring them together if you want to, but traditionally you would keep them separate.
Hmm.
But in America, there's a concept of ancestors. I refer to it as egungun. When you're dealing with indigenous cultures, they tend to repeat a syllable because it's like, you know, egungun means the ones who came before, the ones who came before, the ones who came before. In China, it's jitsun. In, you know, Isis, her name literally means the one who came before, the one who came before, the one who came before. So,
mm-hmm.
like, you know, it keeps on going back and back and back. So I use the word egungun to refer to not just the ancestors of blood, like, you know what I mean, my blood lineage, but also any kind of spirit helper, like, you know, ancestral helper, spirit helper. If there was a poet or a writer or a songwriter or a composer or something
mm-hmm.
that really has in some way, shape, or form affected you deeply.
Yeah.
Like, I have Zora Neale Hurston on my altar because
mm-hmm.
Zora Neale Hurston stimulated Alice Walker to do her work, and Alice Walker was such a huge stimulus for me as a young man. That I have a picture of her. I have, you know, I have specific animal guides that, you know what I mean? So I've got, you know, little fetishes of my little, of my animal guides on my altar. I have, two little dolls of an elderly couple, like, linking hands. And, you know, I think of that as, like, you know, it's sort of simulating grandparents, you know? Yeah. I have, and I mean, it doesn't matter what's on my altar, but I mean, essentially, like, you know what I mean? Anything that you feel really drawn to, the only thing you don't have on your altar is images of deity, because deity is devotion. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
When you're working with deity, you're working, I mean, even if your deity or your primary altar is an altar that is a devotional altar, it also has the potential to be sort of a working altar, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So you wouldn't, like, you know what I mean? If you worked with Isis, you wouldn't put Isis on your,
yeah,
on your ancestral altar.
Mm-hmm.
If you worked with Lilith, you wouldn't put Lilith on your ancestral altar.
Yeah.
And you also don't put any pictures of living people.
Yeah, or,
except
yeah,
for
exactly,
yourself, because it's your
precisely
altar.
You wouldn't,
yeah,
put, so you, if you have, if you want to put your grandmother on the altar, but your mom is in the picture with your grandmother, you don't, and your mom,
yeah,
is still alive, you wouldn't put the picture of your mother and your grandmother on the altar. You want to,
yeah,
find a picture specifically of your
just
grandmother,
your
or
yeah,
grandfather,
mm-hmm,
or whoever the case may be. You can be in the picture because it's your altar.
Right.
You know what,
yeah,
I mean? But you wouldn't... So I've got a great picture of me with my two grandmothers, you know,
mm-hmm,
what I mean? Because they were, like, you know, the life force of, you know, for me as a person growing up. And so I've got this great picture of the three of us, you know, just standing there, me in my cap and gown graduating from school, and, you know, the two of them just so happy and proud of me. Of course, you can, you know, I'm, like, up here, and they're these tiny little women. You know what I mean? So, So, yeah, I mean, but the most basic ancestral altar would be, you know, a glass or a cup of water. You change it weekly, you know, a light source and a picture. And if you want to, you know, and it can grow from that. Like, you know what I mean? It becomes more elaborate as you as an individual start doing that work. And what's interesting is when you start doing the work, other stuff starts to come through. You know, when my,
mm-hmm,
when my mother's mother passed away...
Mm-hmm.
I told this story at the ancestral thing that we've throughout the whole course of my life, there's one thing that was just completely unacceptable in our house, and that was dirty dishes in the sink. You didn't have dirty dishes in your sink. You weren't allowed,
mm-hmm,
to have dirty dishes in the sink. And so, like, you know, that was just the great taboo of growing up, like,
mm-hmm,
you know, and my grandmother, my mother always insisted on, like, you know, leaving a dirty dish in the sink, and I never quite understood it, because her mother and her aunt,
yeah,
and, like, all of these women in the family were, like, you know, it's such a huge taboo. And my grandmother passed away, and I remember I had fallen asleep, and I woke up, and at the time my bedroom was right outside of the kitchen, and there was a light on in the kitchen, and it was I don't know that this happened or if it was vision or a dream or whatever the case may be, but I walked out of my bedroom and into the kitchen, and there was a woman standing at the sink washing a dish. And it was the dish we had left in the sink. I don't know, my partner had left a dish in the sink or something, because
mm-hmm,
he goes to bed after me. And I was like, what are you doing? And she's like, I'm washing your dish. And I was like, why are you washing the dish? And she said, well, because I've washed dishes in your family for years. She said, and now I'm going to be washing your dishes. And I was like, well, who are you? Like, and where's my grandmother? Like, and that's when I was like, where's Nana, you know?
Yeah.
And I remember having this really powerful and vivid dream and getting up, like, I think I woke up from it, like, around 2 o'clock in the morning, went into the kitchen and, like, washed the dish and put it in the strainer or something,
yeah,
and crawled back into bed. And I called my mother and I said, I had the weirdest dream last night. And I was telling my mother about, like, I had this,
mm-hmm,
dream that there was this, she wasn't a black woman, she's a brown woman. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I can't even describe or explain it. And my mother was like, damn it, you got her! And I'm like, got who? What are you talking about? And apparently my grandmother's grandmother's grandmother, they were Irish, and they had this fairy helper who washed the dishes. And so that's why they never left a dirty dish in the sink, because they didn't want her to stick around, because, you know, the Irish Catholic thing and the fairies and everything else. And I was like, you freaking kidding me? Like, you know what I mean? And that's why my mother was always leaving a dirty dish in the sink, because my mother wanted this woman, my mother wanted this fairy helper. My mother wanted to, you know what I mean? My mother didn't understand exactly what it was. I don't think that,
yeah,
to this day she understood it. But so... what I'm getting at is, when you do the ancestral work, you never know what you're going to get. Like,
yeah,
you know what I mean? So
the information you get.
The information you're going to get. And if you have grandparents who are still alive. Mm-hmm. You know, have conversations with them. Like, you know, I'm the repository of all of the family stories.
Yeah.
Because I was willing to sit and listen to my grandmothers tell these amazing stories.
Mm-hmm.
And grandfathers as well. And so I'm sort of the repository in the family. So when somebody in the family wants something, they'll call me and say, do you remember what Nana used to say about da-da-da-da-da or a recipe for so-and-so or whatever the case may be. You just don't know what you're going to get from them or what they're going to bring through for you.
Yeah.
And it can be really powerful and really profound. It can be really mundane, like somebody who washes your dishes. Like, mm-hmm. You know what I mean? But it is, like, you know what I mean? It's very affirming, too, to have that. You know what I mean? To have that experience. It's so affirming of I'm on the right path or mm-hmm. I'm doing the right thing, you know?
I also think it sort of makes you a beacon to the other dead.
Yes, like, yeah, absolutely.
I, on my own personal path, there's a festival I go to every year called Between the Worlds, and there was a man who passed there before I'd even gone to the festival.
Oh, okay.
So I had this dream, and he came to me, and he was talking to me, and he was telling me how to make a crystal grid. And I was like, okay, and whatever. And he told me that his name was Crystal Bear. And I was like, okay, whatever. So I wake up, and I tell Christopher this. And Christopher's like, there was a Crystal Bear, and he did make crystal grids. And I had an amazing experience with his crystal grids. And, you know, telling me all about this. And I'm like, oh, wow, that's kind of creepy, you know. So I did make a crystal grid for him for, like, 3 years in a row. And, like, right now, he's become, like, a sort of a guiding force, like,
yes.
You know, people who've known him have given me, like, the next step on my spiritual journey, and you know, just talking about what he did, you know, so it's amazing what you can experience once you start talking with
him. Right, yeah.
So, all right, Scorpio does death. But it also does the sexual mysteries and as well. So what do you think are the sexual mysteries?
We haven't really talked about that too much.
Yeah, we focused a lot on death and...
Yeah. Well, I feel like that's more of a power, like a thing that needed to be addressed before we did sex. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no,
that makes absolutely sense.
Yeah.
I think the sexual mysteries, there's as much taboo around the sexual mysteries as there is around, you know, just because, you know, we're so Puritan in our thinking. The sexual mysteries are, the first thing we need to do is, like, sort of start having conversations about what it, like, you know what I mean, about the whole concept of sex and sexuality mm-hmm. within the temple itself. We need mm-hmm. to sort of, we need to open up a dialogue about that.
Yeah.
Because I think that there's a lot of misconception about sexuality. I think a lot mm-hmm. of people, does that mean that you do everything sky-clad and da-da-da-da-da? And I'm just like, what does being naked have to do with sex, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, for some people, it's all...
For some people, it is about sex.
But, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, we have to sort of... We have to educate ourselves and sort of change the way we think about sex and sexuality. Because, you know, the temple itself being founded by, you know, a gay man and mm-hmm. gay partners. And the temple itself, you know, I think right now... The largest portion of people in the temple are women and gay, bisexual, transgendered people.
Mm-hmm.
That's a big part of what the temple is all about. And so trying to sort of define and having sort of a healthy understanding of the whole concept of sex and sexuality...
Mm-hmm.
And gender and gender identity. And,
right.
Mm-hmm.
And there's just so many... It's just a huge topic because you have people who are born with both genders or people who, you know, mm-hmm. the Native Americans...
Right, you know, yeah,
and,
I mean...
And just really, you know, not that two-spirited people all have both genitalia, but, you know,
mm-hmm.
just the essence of the two genders. So I think there's a lot to really explore.
I think as people who are sort of enculturated in a Western way, we have this concept of polarity, you know what I mean? This need for male, female, mm-hmm. day, night, you know, good, bad, positive, negative. And I think that in the same way that we've, you know, alienated ourselves from death, you know what I mean? We've yes. alienated ourselves from nature itself because mm-hmm. nature doesn't work in exclusive polarities, you know, mm-hmm. which is why when you're dealing with an indigenous culture, you know, in Africa, there was famous rapper who came back from Africa and was like, you know, in Africa, there's no word for gay. And I was like, yeah, which neglected to mention, there's no word for straight either. Because yeah. the value of who you are in an indigenous culture is from what you have to offer the tribe, what you have to offer the group of people. Mm-hmm. It has nothing to do with who you slept with last night.
Yeah.
You know, and in Native American culture, you know, we know about through, like, you know, the writings of, you know, Will Roscoe and Harry Hay and these really amazing people, this concept of, like, you know, third and fourth gender. And I think when you live, and, you know, this is one of my catchphrases, but when you live naked against the earth, you know, you see the world very differently, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And you notice that nature doesn't work in exclusive polarities. Nature has more than, you know, one tree doesn't look just like another. It doesn't mean it's not mm-hmm. an oak tree. It just yeah. means it doesn't look like that last oak tree you passed, you know? Mm-hmm. So just trying to get through some of the the issues around gender. I mean, you know, I was, you know, I'm a gay man. I came out in, like, the late 80s, and it was a good time to come out, I think, because, mm-hmm. you know, especially in Boston and New England area, because, you know, there was a lot of education. There was a lot of concern about gay youth. You know, gay youth are, like, you know, 1 in 3 kids who commit suicide is a gay kid who's, mm-hmm. you know, in some yeah. way, shape, or form being tortured or bullied. And that whole, you know, that education process, that need to educate mm-hmm. and to make people aware of, like, you know, the issues of gay and lesbian, because you don't suddenly turn up as a gay adult. Like, you know what I mean? You were a gay kid before you were a gay adult. And,
yeah.
you know, the issues of sex and gender, you know, I was raised believing that sex is between your legs and gender is between your ears. So, you know what I mean? You may be born with a particular biological sex, but, like, mm-hmm. how you identify yourself between your ears is entirely your own private experience. And, you know, creating a certain level, and I think that the majority of the people in the temple that I've experienced are very open to and are very comfortable with people of different gender identifications, but also sort of different sexual identifications.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I think that that requires more talking about and more education and more, you know, where is your comfortability level and
mm-hmm.
and where, you know, do we need to push some of those levels? Do we need to do some shadow work on, you know, mm-hmm. sex and sexuality and what does it mean to be, you know, what does it mean to be a straight woman? What does it mean to be a gay man? What does it mean to be a straight man? What does it mean to be a gay woman?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what does it mean to be a transgendered individual? One of the first dialogues that I started when we started this whole thing, one of the things I heard a lot about was, oh, well, you know, rites of passage, you know, let's have rites of passage for, you know, men, for young men becoming, you know, boys becoming men and young girls becoming women. And I was like, well, you know, how about rites of passage for transgender people? Like, how about there's this person who was born female and has transitioned to male,
mm-hmm.
and how about the male community creating, the men's community creating some kind of ritual where they welcome that person into the men's community, and vice versa, you know, a man who's become female, or male to female transgendered person,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, there's people who are like, you know, I mean, I joke about it, but, like, you know, I think of myself as a little black lesbian working it all out through a big white box, you know, mm-hmm. and I joke about it all the time, but in a weird way, I definitely have that, like, you know what I mean, I have that sort of, like, you know, I'm definitely a guy. I mean, I have all of the correct plumbing to be a boy, you know what I mean? And I like boys, you know, but there's a part of me that definitely has that, you know, why did I want to study feminist liberation theology, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, there was this part of me that first started to see differences, and I think I saw them because I was a feminist before I even identified as gay, necessarily. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I think that, like I said, Alice Walker was such a huge part of my growing up process, because if you're in our culture, in American culture, in Western culture, if you're rich, white, heterosexual, able-bodied, Christian, and male, you can look at the end of your nose and you're going to look at a culture that's designed to validate who you are as a person. And the minute you step outside of that rich, white, heterosexual, able-bodied, Christian, male stereotype, you have to look that much further in order to find validation, to the point where some of us have said, you know, I have to find validation within myself, you know? And I think that that stimulates a lot of people towards paganism and towards witchcraft, because they're looking at a culture and they're not seeing themselves reflected in it.
Yeah.
And they're saying, I have to look someplace, I have to find something else. And failing to find it there, I'm going to have to create it. You know, I'm going to have to do something to create it. And I think that that's part of what Christopher has been doing is, you know, or Christopher's sort of like taken up that string and said, well, you know, how far can we take this? You know what I mean? What is it that we're, how can we do this? Mm-hmm. How can we find a place that is safe and acknowledges and honors all of the differences without it being, you know, without it being too cuckoo, you know?
Or at least changing the perception of cuckoo.
Right, yeah, exactly.
You know? Like, exactly. You know, hey, this isn't actually that cuckoo, you know? So my next question was, being a gay man and a straight woman, do you think there are differences in the magic and the mysteries of sex between heterosexual couples and homosexual couples? Tweet, tweet.
We talked about this on the way out a little bit, but go ahead.
I believe that one of the mysteries of the temple is that everyone has the two genders within them. They have the gods and God within them. So I would imagine, I mean, I haven't had homosexual sex, so I can't answer that part. And that's why you're asking that way. But I think I can imagine that the energy coming through is the same. Mm. You know, that it's the sexual energy that comes through, and we can have both kind of polarities within us. And I just believe, you know, the actual physical manifest is different, but I just think it's probably very similar.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, I think that
do you have a different opinion?
No, I don't. I don't think it's different. I think I think that, and you know, this is not a blanket statement. It's just sort of what my perception has been. You know, 42 years that I've been around paying attention, but it's heterosexual couples. There tends to be this concept that, like, you know, I'm seeking somebody to complete me. Like, you know what I mean? There's this like this need to be completed. That this need to be fulfilled. You know, I'm not a whole sort of circle. I'm half a circle or half a pie, and I need that other half of pie to, like, you know, make me a whole pie.
I'm in a canoe, and I need another person to row with
me. Exactly.
Yeah.
And I think in gay relationships, I don't think that we necessarily seek completion. I think that we seek a relationship that's going to mirror back at us, which I think is why gay relationships are, like, so prone to disaster, because who the hell wants to look in a mirror 24/7, you know?
Yeah. Sometimes what's reflected is not pretty.
And the thing is, I don't mean it in a narcissistic, like, you know what I mean? Ooh, I want to look at myself and I want to be, you know, and I think that part of, you know, some of the gay relationships, I think a lot of times they fail because they are narcissistic and, like, you know what I mean? You're, you know, ooh, you know, you're not pretty enough or you're not young enough, and they haven't dealt with all of that, you know, that stuff. But so, you know, heterosexual relationships, and like I said, it's not a blanket statement, because I think that ultimately in most heterosexual relationships, you have to come to the conclusion that I don't need to be completed. It's wonderful if you compliment me. You know, if I'm wearing a brown tux and you're wearing a pink, you know, dress, and I've got a pink bow tie, then hey, we compliment each other, but you could have gone to the prom without me. You know what I mean? Like, we don't complete each other, we compliment each other. But we live in a culture where we're raised to believe that you need to be completed in some way, shape, or form. And I think that that's really messed up. And I think that, you know, gay relationships, you know, we start out with this mentality of, oh, we're looking for somebody to complete me, but really what we're looking for is somebody who mirrors back at us something that we see in ourselves. And if you're doing the work, you know, then the relationship tends to last. Mm-hmm. And if you're not doing the work, then the relationship tends to, you know, fizzle out pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. So that I think that for me is a primary difference between sort of gay relationships and heterosexual relationships. But I don't think that the dynamic creative energies that are raised are necessarily any different. I don't, you know, I think that because I don't know a lot of pagan people who have children. But I, honestly, like, you know what I mean? I don't see a lot of pagan relationships, like, you know what I mean? You know, popping out children. And I think that it's a very conscious decision on our, you know, it's a conscious decision on the parts of these people, you know what mm-hmm. I mean, of looking at the world and going, do I really want to bring a child into this world right now? Yeah. And, you know, what kind of relationship am I bringing the child into and stuff? So we think about things, you know, we ponder things. It's part, like, again, it's part of being a witch. Like, you know, we ponder things differently. We think about things differently. Mm-hmm. So I think that that creates the same dynamic creative energy. Yeah. It's just, you know, how do we choose to direct that energy? You know, mm-hmm. it's raising energy, bottom line. Yeah. Where do you direct the energy?
I think there's another level, though. There are people who choose not to be in a relationship. Mm-hmm. And they can raise that energy all by themselves.
Oh, yes. Yes. Absolutely. Yes.
And I think that's an important piece. And that's where I say, you know, it's both they both come mm-hmm. through
yes.
one person.
Yeah. I think that the differences sometimes are where the energy is directed. Like, mm-hmm. sometimes with a heterosexual couple, it may be directed towards fertility.
Right.
Having a child.
Of course.
Whereas,
and that's,
you know,
also...
it may also be directed towards pleasure. You know, they have that option. But
whereas
I also... Whereas with gay men or gay women or, you know, whatever combination you choose to go with, the energy isn't directed towards anything but experiencing each other or getting to that mirror space.
Right.
But I also want to put out there that I feel like we sometimes get wrapped up in the physical gender.
Yes.
And don't take into account that these are just physical genders. This is two spirits coming together.
Yes.
And bringing out the love that comes from when you pull those two polarities together. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And let them boom.
Yeah.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
So, well, thank you guys. This
thank
has been
you,
a long but good interview. So, we'll say goodbye to our listeners. See you later.
Thanks for coming.
Thanks.
So that was our interview. I hope you enjoyed it. We covered a lot of ground and some very interesting topics. I'm just going to do our DM vocation, and we'll say goodbye. We thank the Great Spirit and the two who move as one. We thank the three rays of love, will, and wisdom. We thank the God and Goddess who move through us and work with us. May we recognize their presence in our lives. Blessed be. Merry meet, merry part, and merry meet again. Blessed be, everyone. You've been listening to Voices of the Temple. The contents of this podcast are copyright 2010 of the Temple of Witchcraft. For more information, please visit templeofwitchcraft.org.